This is an ABC podcast.
Nisan Bolivinaka Talohani and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. As always, we'd like to acknowledge that Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Well, wherever you're tuning in from, we really appreciate it. Remember, you can find our stories online once our show is done. Simply type Pacific Beat Radio Australia into your search engine. Well, with only a week away, we'll be bringing you coverage on the upcoming elections in the Solomon Islands. And what does a leaked document from Tonga's Foreign Affairs Ministry show? And when the popular saying, sky's the limit, is how three women in PNG are helping their community. More on those stories shortly. And yes, we are across Facebook and Instagram at ABC Pacific. If you have not done so yet, head there, like and follow us. But let's get on with the show. I'm Aggie DeBoer and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. A lot of eyes will be on Solomon Islands when people go to the polls next week to cast their votes in the country's general election. Two of those eyes belongs to James Batley, former Australian High Commissioner to Solomon Islands, now Distinguished Policy Fellow at the Australian National University. He's back in Honiara as part of the joint ANU and Solomon Islands National University Election Observer team. Now, they won't just be observing the conduct of the vote itself. They'll also be talking to voters about the issues that are weighing on their minds ahead of the poll. To tell us more, James Batley joins us now. Good morning, James.
Good morning, Aggie.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. I must say, what's it like to be back in Honiara in the run-up to the election?
Oh, well, it's always great to be back in Honiara. There's certainly, you can feel that there's an election in the air. There's a lot of candidate posters and banners around town. There's a lot of talk on the radio and TV about the election. I don't think it's quite reached its peak yet, the campaign period. I think that'll happen over the next week before the blackout, 24 hours before the election day itself.
Well, James, tell us about the ANU senior sort of observers. I mean, how many are there of you and what really will you be doing?
Yeah, this is the third time that ANU has done a serious election observation exercise, but this time we've really taken it to a new level by formalising our partnership with Solomon Islands National University. So we've got almost 90 observers divided into 15 teams, so they're distributed in about one third of the constituencies around the country, right across the country, and 90% of our observers, of course, are Solomon Islanders themselves. So we have a small team here from ANU as well. So they will be in the field. They've started deploying on the weekend, and they've started work already, and they'll be in the field for almost 3 weeks. So during the campaigning period on election day itself, and then we'll do some survey work after the elections as well.
And I'm wondering, what sort of questions will you be asking people, even into the lead up to the poll?
Well, we're interested in the opinions of citizens about why they register to vote where they do. We're interested in the qualities that they are looking for in political candidates. We're interested in the way that candidates conduct their campaigns, whether it's through public rallies or social media and so on. We're interested in people's attitudes about women candidates as well. Of course, there were only a handful of women in the last parliament, and indeed there's only a handful of women who've put themselves up for election this time around. But we will. Those are all questions that we've asked before and that we'll ask again this time. So when we do get our results, we will be able to identify trends over time.
Yeah, and even with those trends, I must say, you said this is the third time you've done this. Even in the last two, do you feel there'll be a bit of a change up with this upcoming election?
Well, look, I don't want to to second guess what we might come up with in the course of this. But I think it will be interesting to track. I think in particular the attitudes, the expectations that voters have of their candidates and of the people who become their representatives in Parliament. There's a very strong belief that members of Parliament should actively assist their communities and people that voted for them. And of course, Solomon Islands has got a very well-developed constituency development fund system. So I think that's one area where we'll be particularly interested to see whether people's attitudes are evolving.
James, when doing this type of work, what is the value of this kind of qualitative data?
Well, I think the first thing it does, it helps the Solomon Islands system, so the Electoral Commission. The observations that we make will be of help to the electoral officials here and will help them in future elections and in any reforms that they propose in future for the electoral process. Research, clearly, around about our observers, Solomon Islands National University, and they have the opportunity to do active on the ground to learn more about their. So we hope that we are making a real contribution to Solomon Islanders' own of and as I said before, the other thing that's coming out of this is not just data but trends over. I think that will be helpful on all of those fronts.
Absolutely. Thank you for that, James. We are just experiencing a bit of a cutout there while you're talking, but we will keep trying. But if you've just joined us here in Pacific Beat, we're speaking to former Australian High Commissioner to Solomon Islands, now Distinguished Policy Fellow at the Australian National University, James Batley, on the upcoming elections in the Solomon Islands. I know, again, like you said, it's early days yet, but again, the preparations, how do they appear to be going? Are we all set?
I think so. The electoral officials seem to be confident. And appear to be well prepared. There's a lot of information being pushed out, awareness over the radio. I heard a great item yesterday talking about disabled voters, and if you were physically incapable of getting inside a polling station, then electoral officials have the right to bring out polling papers to you if you're outside their station. So, I think those sort of messages are good. Clearly, all the candidates have been hard at work. So I think things are pretty much set for the 17th of April.
Nice. And also, a lot of partners are actually helping Solomon Islands, conduct the elections. You've got the likes of China, Australia, and even New Zealand. Are you seeing that evidence of that assistance?
It's very much in the background at the moment. Certainly, the Australian Defence Force and New Zealand Defence Force will have significant roles to play in helping with the logistics side of the election, and if necessary, on the security side. But they're not particularly visible here at the moment. There have been the Australian Electoral Commission have been here and are still here in the lead up to the election. The UNDP has got an important program of support as well. So those are the main external partners that are supporting the election.
And finally, James, where will you yourself be on election day?
I will be in Honiara, in the capital city, running between the three constituencies that make up Honiara City.
Well, look, James, we really thank you for your time this morning. I know you are counting down the days as you get closer to the election date, but we do thank you for your insight this morning.
It's a pleasure.
No worries. That, of course, is James Batley, Distinguished Policy Fellow there at the Australian National University. While we turn our focus to Tuvalu's government, where they say it will ratify a landmark security treaty with Australia, ending months of speculation over concerns the treaty would affect the Pacific nation's sovereignty. It comes as residents of the low-lying atoll nation recover from devastating king tides, with some describing it as the worst they've seen. As Doug Dingwall reports, there's questions whether Tuvalu's culture can survive a relocation of its people to Australia.
Angela Telepe's backyard on Tuvalu's main island of Funafuti is usually a place for her family to have picnics, but in February it went underwater.
It just reaches the step, but it covers this whole area. Like, as you can see, the kids can swim in the water because of the king tide.
The king tide covered the area, damaging her crops and flooding nearby homes.
Our neighbor's house, the one of my relatives live in, they live to the shoreline. They had to evacuate because of the strong wind and plus the king tide. They had to evacuate because the water was coming right inside. The waves were just washing inside the house.
The February king tide grew larger with heavy rainfall and strong winds and waves, damaging the main road on Funafuti. Authorities say the king tides hit areas not affected in previous years. It was followed weeks later by another tide rise. All this took place as Tuvalu considered the Falapilla Union Treaty, which would let its people escape the impacts of climate change by migrating to Australia. Prime Minister Feleti Teo says his government is ratifying the treaty, despite concerns about a clause allowing Australia to veto any security agreements Tuvalu makes with any other country.
So the new administration has undertaken to proceed with the treaty with the assurance that provision will never be abused. By Australia. Most Tuvaluans, if you ask them, they don't want to leave Tuvalu, they want to stay here. But for their own reason that decides to move, I think it's the government's responsibility to create those pathways for them to be able to migrate with dignity rather than being compelled and forced to leave.
Australian National University climatologist Mark Howden says sea level rise is accelerating and will change how king tides affect communities.
The tides themselves are caused by movements of the moon relative to the earth, and that isn't particularly influenced by climate change. But what does happen is as the sea level rises on average, so that the sea level goes up, it means that any given king tide could go further inland than it otherwise would, causing more floods than it otherwise would.
He says it's still possible for Tuvalu to remain inhabitable into the future if the world rapidly decreases its greenhouse gas emissions. But the king tides this year had Tuvaluans like Angela Telepe questioning their future in their homeland as sea levels rise with climate change.
I think it's a good opportunity also for my people to see another way that Australia is offering a better pathway.
While some Tuvaluans are open to migrating to Australia if they have to, they fear it could come at a cost to their culture. Former Tuvalu Prime Minister and current MP, Enele Sopoanga, says there's a need to protect the rights of Tuvalu to exist as a nation and community regardless of climate change.
Relocation in that regard, it could be an option, but you know, relocation in the process under which and through which the Tuvalu nation will remain as Tuvalu, and therefore Tuvalu will continue to enjoy its full rights, social rights, cultural rights, and fundamental human rights to be able to exist as a nation, as a community of Tuvalu. Whether these things are being taken care of by the Falapilla Union, I'm not sure.
The Office of Australia's Pacific Minister, Pat Conroy, did not comment when approached. However, the treaty would recognise Tuvalu's continuing statehood in the face of climate change. Prime Minister Feleti Teo believes Tuvaluans can keep their culture alive if they move to Australia.
And that's Doug Dingwall with that report. an entrepreneur in Papua New Guinea, is using her skills to share her knowledge to help women artisans in her local community earn a living as well as strengthening their culture. Esther Sione Daniels is the founder and owner of Tehina Trend, based in the New Ireland province. She sources fashionable wear and jewellery from the local women and sells them online. Most of the jewellery are made from seashells or natural resources from the environment. And after attending the Pacific Greenpreneurs Accelerator program in Fiji in 2023, Daniels' work has been recognised in PNG and the wider region. Caroline Terriman spoke with her.
I'm an entrepreneur, fashion designer and owner of a craft and fashion local business, and it's called Tehina Trend. Tehina means woman in my language, and why I chose the name was because I mostly sold ladies' jewelry, garments and accessories that not only styled, but I believe gave confidence and empowerment to women who wore the pieces. In 2018, I helped some artisans who create jewelry, and I purchased their handicrafted pieces, and then I incorporated these pieces into my own contemporary earrings. So I sold them on social media platforms, especially Facebook. And the reason why I purchased these handcrafted pieces from local artisans was because I wanted to help them, at least to buy the pieces from them and help them to earn money as well. My business grew online and eventually got registered under IPA after a year of operation. So in 2020, my business was awarded a PNGA Scholarship for an Entrepreneurship and New Venture Creation, a Certificate 4, which I attended at the University of Sunshine Coast, Queensland. This was when I implemented what I learned upon completion into my small business, and I diversified the products into a fashion line, so from jewelry to fashion line. Hence, it was an innovative concept that integrated my fashion line, my crafts and jewelry, which were sourced from local artisans. So in 2022, my business, Tehina Trend, was again selected to take part in the Pacific Greenpreneur Program. It was run by Global Green Growth Institute. And for this, I saw that it added an environmental value to our products through utilizing natural resources responsibly to minimize carbon footprint and contribute towards solving environmental issues through our use of safe hand tools instead of large machinery. So my business collaborated with local artisans to create products which also embody culture and craftsmanship.
In 2003, you attended the Pacific Greenpreneurs Acceleration Program in Fiji. What was that all about?
In Fiji, we networked with other businesses who also had the same goals of helping to solve environmental issues with their businesses. I also met a mother and daughter business in Fiji that involved collecting jewelry from local women and also selling on their online platform and shop. So all in all, one common thing I observed was how similar the business in other Pacific Islands were to our businesses in Papua New Guinea. Hence, the challenges that we face are all quite similar. Examples, we needed trainings on how to obtain finances for the business, etc. So last year, Tehina Trend was also part of the 16 green businesses, the group, that went on a study trip to Qatar next to Dubai, which we visited businesses and companies that tried to solve climate change through use of resources from the environment. So all these experiences, they kind of like grew my business and it added value to my business.
When they're making the arts and crafts, what are they using from the environment?
The local artisans, they use shells picked from around their surroundings. For example, they use very unique shells that collected from the deep ocean, and sometimes the shells are quite hard to find because, of course, they're unique. So one thing I like about the local people here is it's a heritage that has been passed down from generations, and they have continued to use these skills and talent of making these jewelries. The jewelries are handmade. They only use the simplest hand tools they can find to create shells, and the shells are very neat. They don't need big machinery and stuff like that, you know, that will pollute the environment.
Since you have been working with them, have they been happy with how things are going for them?
They've been very happy. Actually, every time they do new design, they're very happy to let me know about their designs, because I provide jewelry blades. These are blades that I order through online platforms, and I sell them to them at a low price. And these people have been very happy. They're able to pay for their children's school fees. They're able to attend ceremonies or events in the communities. You know, we have challenges, financial challenges and financial contributions. And this has really helped them to earn money to also sustain their livelihoods. Yes, and also because the number of artisans in New Ireland province has increased over the years, and we don't really have a big town here. We have only a small population of people who go to the market and all that. So they really need access. One thing I saw that I realized and observed was that they needed access to the online market, which I am also helping. My business has also helped to market the product.
What are your plans for the future?
I have diversified into another product, and that's basically printing T-shirts and printing tumblers, water bottles. And tumblers is to reduce the amount of, you know, plastics and recycled plastics that people buy from shops and just throw around. So the tumbler, when people travel around, they just use the water bottle or tumbler. It's aluminium and it's safer than plastic. That's my next product. Well, actually, the first batch all been sold out. Now I'm just creating my next batch of water tumbler. And also, it's safe for the environment. And my next step is to have a fixed position in the market, especially in the global market, basically to export the jewelry collected from people around here. I'll continue to sell to other provinces and mainly to export to another country. We've exported twice to Australia, and now we're looking at exporting to other countries as well.
And that's Caroline Terriman with that story.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sportspeople to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Thabol. Well, our next story is talking about a leaked document from Tonga's Foreign Affairs Ministry shows officials sharply criticised Australia and New Zealand's response to a security pact signed by China and Solomon Islands in 2022. The document declared that Pacific diplomacy from Western nations was failing. It's a rare insight into what diplomats in the region were thinking at the height of the geopolitical competition for influence in the region. So joining us this morning is ABC's Foreign Affairs reporter, Stephen Jidgets. With that, I say good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, Aggie.
Thank you very much. I know it is very early for us, but I do appreciate your time. And now, look, this document is from 2022. I mean, what were the diplomats in Tonga thinking as both Australia and New Zealand sort of went into overdrive in their response to Solomon Islands signing that controversial security treaty with China?
Yeah, I think what this document gives us is a really valuable little window about on what some Pacific officials were thinking around that 2022 window when Australia and New Zealand, as you say, were pressing on smaller Pacific nations to try and heap pressure on Solomon Islands over its contentious security pact with China. The document, it's about 5 pages long. It includes an acknowledgement near the beginning that there are potential complications with China's presence in the Pacific and potentially this security agreement. It says, for example, that there are, you know, that there are risks that are presented by growing indebtedness of Pacific Island states to China as it becomes, you know, more present in the region. But the bulk of the document dwells more on the shortcomings of Australia and New Zealand as it's perceived by these Tongan officials. So, for example, they call the response from New Zealand nothing short of frantic, saying that New Zealand's foreign minister, which was then Nanaia Mahuta, was angling for a phone call with Tonga's then foreign minister to express grave concerns over the deal. The letter also, the document also talks about how New Zealand and Australia were engaged in what it calls reactionary behaviour. In other words, there was an element of panic in what they were doing. And it also says that fundamentally, in the end, Tonga should not criticise or press Solomon Islands on the matter because, whether it was a good idea or not, in the end, it was a call for for Solomon Islands and Solomon Islands alone. So basically saying that in the end, this was fundamentally a question of sovereignty and that Pacific Island nations, in the end, were not in a position to press Solomon Islands over the agreement with China, even if they did harbour a few resentments. So I think what the letter shows is not that, that these officials were entirely on board with China's presence in the region or that they didn't harbour any doubts. But in the end, they're not. There is a big gap between what they think about Beijing's presence in the region and what Australia and New Zealand think. There is, at least to some extent, a bit of a disconnect there.
Mm. Yeah, I know. You talk about the complications, the risks, even the outcomes of being in debt. But what's interesting enough is the word condescending was the word the document used to describe the leadership reaction. I mean, would Australia and NZ be embarrassed by this description? I mean, do we know if we've heard from Australia and New Zealand on this?
Well, we've heard from New Zealand's government that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Trade has issued a response with maybe just a touch of acid to it, saying that it's up to, that it's a matter for Tonga about how their officials brief the government. But it reiterates New Zealand's basic point that they still hold deep reservations about the security agreement with China, describing it as unnecessary and unwelcome. So New Zealand is essentially saying that it was very right for it to raise its concerns about the agreement. It's not stepping back at all in that regard. We haven't yet heard from the Australian government, but I imagine that they'll issue perhaps a statement later today about it. Will they be embarrassed about it? Yes, to some degree. I mean, it won't be welcome to them they will not welcome the fact that this document has been made public because it does highlight that disconnect that I was referring to. And it also makes it harder for Australia to maintain this line that it uses a little bit, or it has until recently, about its desire for the Pacific family to take to simply maintain the line on security agreements. Australia likes to blur that line a little bit. This letter shows that blurring is a little bit hopeful, perhaps. None of this means, of course, Aggie, that there aren't actual concerns and a level of disquiet in the Pacific about the China-Solomon Islands deal or about China's presence more broadly. I've spoken to enough people in the Pacific, at least in Pacific governments over the years, to know that there are some people, who do harbour deep reservations about it. But it's a more complicated picture than Australia might like.
Yeah, before we get into it a little bit more, someone you have actually spoken to is the Pacific analyst Dr. Anna Poles about this document. What was her take on it?
Yeah, well, her take is basically that this does demonstrate that disconnect between Australia and New Zealand and the rest of the Pacific. you know, and I think that's true. Now, her other point is that even if Tonga doesn't really intend it to be this way, it does amount in a degree to a legitimization of others coming in, including China, as security actors. Now, the line that Australia and others have consistently used was that, you know, that in the end it's up to the, quote, Pacific family to look after security, and that other players from outside the region, particularly China, are not really welcome. Incidentally, it is worth saying that the fact that, you know, Japan and the US are now playing an increasingly prominent role in security in the region presents a little bit of an awkward question to Australia on that front. It puts a bit of pressure on that linguistic formation, which might explain why Australia more recently is not really using the term Pacific family only, but instead Pacific family led rather than Pacific family only. Yeah. But, you know, nonetheless, you know, it's very clear that Australia sees China as basically a malign security actor. It's comfortable enough, at least to a degree, with China's presence in the region. It knows that it can't extinguish China as a major regional player. China is simply far too deeply embedded in the region for it to push against that. But Australia and New Zealand would like to hold the line on security. It would like China to be essentially relegated at best to the margins on security. And what Dr. Poles and others are saying, and what this document demonstrates, is that is going to be quite difficult.
Okay, if you're just tuning in to Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia, I'm speaking to ABC's foreign affairs reporter Stephen Jedgett on this leaked document that is sharply criticising Australia and New Zealand's response to a security pact that was signed by China and Solomon Islands back in 2022. Look, Stephen, this document is from 2 years ago. I'm wondering, are there any valuable lessons here for Canberra and Wellington? Because do you even still think it's relevant in this current geopolitical situation in the country?
Look, I mean, I think it is, to some degree at least, still relevant, even though it is 2 years old, because I don't think the strands of thought that it captures have disappeared at all from the Pacific. You could make the argument that it's perhaps a bit less prominent than it was 2 years ago, in the sense that I think there probably is a little bit more scepticism towards China in the Pacific than there might have been 2 years ago when the news of the security agreement first broke. I think some Pacific elites are perhaps a little bit more aware now of some of the complicating factors that emerge with China's presence in the region growing, particularly in the security front. And at least to some degree, you know, I think Pacific diplomats and officials are perhaps a little bit more wary of Beijing than they might have been a few years ago. But I do think it's still relevant, because I think this strand that runs through Pacific government thinking that, one, even if China is increasingly assertive, in the end, you know, Australia and the US have long been assertive and major security players in the region. So they're perhaps broadly comparable. So given they're all equally self-interested and at times malevolent, there's little you can do other than throw up your hands and simply point to Pacific Island sovereignty. Two, the argument that in the end Australia's attitude whenever it tries to, or New Zealand's attitude whenever it tries to press on this front, is inevitably and unavoidably condescending and disrespectful towards Pacific Island sovereignty. That strand of thinking, whilst by no means the only strand of thinking within Pacific Island governments, does persist, perhaps particularly in foreign ministries around the region. And it's one that Australia will continue to have to grapple with.
Yeah, and something that obviously we will wait until there is some sort of response from them later this afternoon. But Stephen, it is always great to catch up with you.
No problem, Maggie. Thanks so much for having
Thanks me. Thanks again. Thanks again for your time. That is ABC's foreign affairs reporter, Stephen Jedgett. Well, let's head to Papua New Guinea, where three young women have realised the phrase, the sky is the limit, by training to become helicopter pilots, doing humanitarian work in the most remote parts of the country. It took time, determination and hard work to reach their dream of flying with local company Manolo's Aviation. Hilda Wayne with the story.
Annette Gele was one of many young Papua New Guineans who rode to Manolo's Aviation, hoping to become a pilot. It was what she wrote in a job application that caught the attention of Manolo's Aviation owner, Jürgen Ruhl.
So this particular lady, Annette, she wrote to us and she said she always wanted to be a pilot. and was wondering whether we would give her a chance. And I looked through her CV and I noticed that after school, she worked on the YWAM ship. And as a volunteer on the YWAM ship, I know you cannot just volunteer on the YWAM ship. You must actually pay to volunteer. So I was wondering, how did you manage to become a volunteer on the YWAM ship? And then she said, well, I wanted to work on the YWAM ship. So I wake up at 3 a.m. I bake muffins and I sold muffins in front of our house. And then I had some money. My parents helped me and I used the money to be a volunteer on the YWAM ship. And that really was an eye-opener for me. Because number one, I've seen that somebody is determined. And apart from being determined to serve others, she was determined to earn her own money to serve others. This lady, apart from having also good school results, is so determined to help others, as I knew that she would fit in well with us, with the work we are doing.
Mr. Roo said two other women, Dorothy Kay and Deborah Bidang, have also trained to become pilots with the hope of flying unassisted within 3 years.
The private pilot's license they have got is a first step in 100 miles. But having made that first step, I do know that number one, they understand basic theory, and number two, they know how to fly a helicopter. So many people struggle with one or the other, but two of them didn't struggle with neither. They passed their theory exam and they did their private exam as well. So from here now, for two of them, we make many other steps now to make sure they're, you know, by the end of the year, hopefully we've got a commercial pilot, a young commercial pilot flying with an experienced pilot.
And it says what they have achieved is not just for them and their families, but for the people they work to help.
You gain experience on working every day and accepting the challenges. For me, I think in Papua New Guinea, there's not a lot of opportunities for young girls to pursue this career. And it took a long time. And as far as I can remember, it's something that I always wanted to do, to fly. But it's quite expensive and the opportunities are not just available there for us. And so just having a dream and eventually applying to Manalos and not knowing what it would be, whether they'd respond to me or not. But having had this opportunity, it has really boosted me. And it's not easy. It's very challenging. But what keeps me going is the thought that it's there are other young girls out there who don't have the opportunities that we do have. And that's what keeps all of us going, to make the most of what we have.
Dorothy Case is one of her biggest challenges was being overlooked as a female and waiting 2 years after graduation to be given a job.
One of the challenges which I faced when I was trying to work as an engineer, applying for a job when I finished my studies, it was the unequal opportunity for women career advancement. Most of the boys we studied together, they got job, but like a few girls we started that trades, we didn't get an opportunity to work in the industry. Like I was waiting for 2 years before I got the job offer from Manalos Aviation.
Jorgen Roo said one thing that stood out with work ethic of women is their dedication and commitment to work.
And from the time she started work, I saw a level of commitment a female can put into the job once she's given a chance. Huh?
PNG women leader and gender advocate Grace Nari says it is encouraging for the fight for gender equality in PNG, and to see three more young women pilots is encouraging for gender equality in PNG.
They would get there and they make some of us proud. So if more girls are joining those girls in those higher ranks and positions and odd jobs, we would have a place one time. Slowly and quietly, I mean, I'm very impressed and I'm happy. And I know that our women and girls will make this gender equality a reality in this country when more of them tap into areas where it's been male-dominated.
Dorothy Kay says she's looking forward to continue with Manalos Aviation and reaching rural communities of PNG.
I see myself as a commercial pilot helping our Mama Medivac program. Our helicopters, they go out to the rural areas and we go and we bring the mothers from the rural areas who have bad complications. So that's what I see myself doing as a pilot
in the future. And also, I am a helicopter mechanic, so I see myself as fixing and flying.
She says what Deborah Bidang, Anat Gele and herself have achieved so far is testament to discipline and commitment to work and encourages young women to do more for themselves.
There is a prevailing perception that aviation is a male-dominated field and people think that women are less capable of or suitable for certain roles within the industry. We can do what men do, you know. So my advice to the young girls in PNG is nothing is impossible as long as we set our mind to it and focus. We can achieve anything we want to do in life.
And that is Pilot Gavithi Kay ending that story from Hilda Wayne. Well, guess what? It is the end of Pacific Beat. I'll be back same time tomorrow, 6 a.m. PNG time. Up next is your news and then Nita Daily. I'm Aggie Thabol and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.